Welcome to the 56th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
I'm Toby Chad.
And as Stuart Broad moans about being forced to play on in dangerous weather, welcome to the podcast that's played much of its best cricket during thunderstorms.
And indeed, this is a multi-weather podcast. Andy's sitting there in an English spring, I'm here in an Australian autumn. And obviously the eyes of the world are at the moment glued on the T20 tournament that's happening. Andy, have you been interested by it?
Well, the preliminary group phase of the World 2020, I think we all expected it to be sort of very much a slow build-up, nothing too interesting going on, and it's ended up just being an amazing start. I'm sure all of our listeners are often in this position where you're at work, you stick the Crick Info scorecard of a game in the background, and what's been happening to me all of this week is that the game just becomes utterly brilliant and you find yourself completely immersed. I think the best example of this was Nepal's game against Afghanistan. I mean, I would be very surprised to know that I would find myself spending most of a morning at work just following Nepal versus Afghanistan. But I think the Nepalese have probably won themselves an awful lot of fans during the last
couple of weeks. For the sake of your job, we probably shouldn't tell our listeners what you do.
It's the British taxpayers' money well spent, I would say.
Say no more. I think the good thing about this World Cup has been, you know, there are always these debates about the fact that the World Cup goes on for too long, usually in the context of 50-over game. But what they've managed to do is they've managed to actually shorten the main business of the World Cup and to keep the minnows involved. And they've, you know, they've killed two birds with one stone. And I think that's a pretty good achievement.
I think the ICC deserves a lot of credit for giving the associates a chance. But the key thing is the associates have really seized that chance. I mean, I'm one of probably a lot of fans who would now consider watching associate cricket more. I mean, the skill level has been really quite high. In the Nepalese-Afghanistan game, Jitendra Makhaya, who won the Man of the Match award in that, the Crick Info guy was constantly comparing him to Malinga in it. And I watched the highlights afterwards. He was bowling these brilliant Yorkers at will. I mean, this was like a high standard of very competitive cricket. And I think the other thing that's I realised watching this is that it's not just about giving the associates exposure to playing big teams. It's about getting them to play in front of big crowds. You could just see the way the Nepalese were relishing playing at Chittagong in front of a big crowd. I mean, I thought that was just such an important experience as part of their development. So you've been away from Chittagong. You've been looking at beautiful images in the Caribbean.
I've been looking at the internet now. About 18 months ago now, we interviewed Philip Brown, the photographer, on this podcast. And he told me I asked him what his best ever image was, and he told me a wonderful story about being in the West Indies and coming across a beach where a father and his son was playing cricket, and it was the picture of the son playing a cover drive into the ocean that was his favourite image, or the image that he had most pride in. And he's taken another beautiful image of a chap who goes by the name of Cabbage. And this was taken during a 2020 game in Antigua during the recent West Indies England series. And what's wonderful about it is that often these particularly these one day series and these 2020 series, they sort of all merge into one and they get a bit monotonous. And what I like about this image is it's actually saying something that's very important, which is that there are things within each game, there are characters within each game which can add flavour and, you know, add them to the memory in a way that the game sometimes can't. And I think what Philip Brown is doing here is quite important, because actually, you know, you go back to the great old commentators of the game, you go back to Alan Ross, you go back to John Arlott, for instance, and then in a sort of more comic way to Henry Blofeld recently with his buses and his pigeons. And these are all people who find the experience of cricket in the little things that are happening within the game. And I think this image is a wonderful experience of that.
I think what I enjoyed about it when you shared it with me is the fact that there's been so much in recent years about how the West Indies has kind of fallen out of love with cricket. You know, there's just not the same.
Yep.
I mean, there was a great example in the West Indies World Cup where, you know, the ICC made it impossible for the bands to come in. And I know it's just one guy, but it was just great. It was great to be reminded that there's still plenty of passion for the game.
Exactly, that passion.
The game
Caribbean. Definitely. It's on. So the image is on Crick Info. We will tweet it as well when we tweet the podcast. So what has had you disappointed about the last couple of weeks in cricket?
Well, I mean, Giles Clarke is pretty much an individual who provides eternal reasons for anger and disappointment, but he kind of hit new levels of late. It's been revealed that he spoke to Sky during the Ashes, complaining that Shane Warne had been overly critical of the England team. I mean, only an astonishing level of arrogance can give Giles Clarke the belief that he has any right to complain about what a cricket commentator is saying about the England
team. And also that it's going to have any other result than just backfiring on him. I mean, we saw it recently with when India tried to shut down commentators who were critical of them, and that just backfired with everyone saying the BCCI is, you know, as it is, a bit of a sort of draconian, totalitarian governing body. And how he saw that this was going to in any way improve the English image of English cricket, I don't really know.
I think it's incredibly sad that only a few episodes ago we mentioned this thing about the BCCI being censoring their commentators, and it's incredibly sad to see the ECB showing the same impulses. Mm. But I think this is part of a wider problem in sort of Team England that was brought up very well by Jonathan Agnew, actually, after the recent Ashes series, where he just said this England team need to get less defensive and better at learning from criticism. There is a lot going wrong at the moment, and if they genuinely believe that they have nothing to learn from anyone else, they have serious, serious problems.
Now, talking about bungling administrators who have a lot to learn, the ICC tour programme, I mean, we talk about it quite a lot on the podcast, but it is an ongoing shambles. And the most recent thing that caught my eye was the announcement that the South African tour of Sri Lanka was going to be 2 tests and 3 one-day internationals. And, you know, it's an increasing trend that test series are shorter and shorter, and then the one-day internationals afterwards are greater in number. But I think, you know, it's just not giving a proper chance to the game to survive if, you know, we can't actually have closely fought series. When it's only 2 games, that just can't happen. And the other rather sort of infuriating thing about this is the reason this has come about is because the Sri Lankan 2020 sort of Premier League has proved immovable, and the administrators have had to juggle around the test series so they can fit around it. And the whole idea of the 2020 league was that it would be there to serve the greater interests of the game. But in fact, what we've seen fairly inevitably, I think, is that the game has sort of had to fit around it, and that the test game has been denigrated as a result.
I think what's very sad, actually, is that we're now getting so many more of these 2 test series, and even actually 3 test series when it should really be 5, that I think it's becoming the norm. You know, it's something that we've moaned about before on this podcast, but it's becoming quite established and sort of very...
I think I'm right in saying that actually the only people who regularly play 5 test series are England and Australia. I mean, and that's not right.
You know, and the fact that South Africa and Australia, the brilliant recent series they had, the fact they didn't have the chance to settle over 5... I mean, we've talked before on this podcast about the World Test Championship, and I don't think, and it's now gone and that idea has been shelved for the moment, but I don't think it was necessarily the answer to all our problems. But at least I think what it would have done by giving a sort of final end point, I think it would have forced a lot of this stuff to become a bit more regimented and a bit less of this. You know, it shouldn't just be constantly negotiable. It shouldn't be like, oh, let's knock a test off here, let's knock a test off there. It should be much more established than that. From the archives, in this episode, Toby is going to introduce us to the frankly surprising relationship between one of Britain's greatest ever female authors and the sport of cricket.
So it was sent to me in an email by a friend who I had introduced to cricket via Middlesex T20 at Lord's. And it was a black and white photo of 2 girls playing cricket, presumably sometime in the late 19th century. One poses a forward defensive shot. There's a large gap between her bat and her pad, although ultimately there's no pad, just an ankle-length black dress. But otherwise it's a very proper shot, shaping to play the ball under her eyes. The other girl, standing behind, cradles a ball in her upraised hands and looks on admiringly. The content is utterly familiar. The style, the distinctively 19th century dress, and the gender of the participants is less so. And the incongruity becomes greater when we realise that the subjects of the photo are none other than English writer, philosopher and trailblazing feminist and modernist Virginia Woolf and her sister Vanessa.
I think what I found extraordinary when I saw this photo for the first time is that you always think of Virginia Woolf as someone of just utter seriousness. As you said, you know, she fought for a difficult cause in feminism at a difficult time in history. And, you know, her writing deals with very sort of serious ideas. And there was something wonderful about seeing someone of that ilk just at play, at ease, just enjoying themselves.
Yeah, totally. So just for the sake of context, Woolf lived from 1882 to 1941. And there's one really famous photo of her, and I think this is probably the one that you're sort of referring to, where she's sort of looking mistily into the middle distance. And she's simultaneously looking sort of quite feminine, and we're going to have feminists galore writing to us about this, but anyway, simultaneously quite feminine and also very strong-sighted. What's interesting is that a lot of this childhood cricket is actually quite well documented that Woolf plays. So Woolf herself says this: "Vanessa and I were both what we call tomboys. That is, we played cricket, scrambled over rocks, climbed trees, were said not to care for clothes and so on." Now,
I just find really fascinating about this is that, so in a previous life, I was a teacher, and I remember one of the big problems that the school had generally is getting girls to be enthusiastic about sport. It was seen as a very unfeminine thing for a lot of the teenage girls to do. They didn't want to go out and, you know, play football, get money, whatever. And I think actually, it's funny, but in its own way, and especially at this time in history, going out and playing cricket as a girl probably was a sort of minor act of rebellion. It was quite a brave thing
well,
to do.
What's interesting for the Woolf family is that it's very much embedded into their everyday life. So Stella, who was Virginia's stepsister, so Virginia's sister from her father's first marriage, kept a diary. And in 1893, in the month of August, the book is available on Google Books, which is where I'm reading it from now. And it says things like this: 15th of August, children bathed, cricket. 17th of August, very hot, cricket after tea. 18th of August, wild cricket. And I'm quite curious about what wild cricket exactly
that
is.
Sounds great.
23rd of August, photographed cricket. 24th of August, father took a boat. Nessa, mother and I settled down to paint in the rose garden. Swimming races, water polo, tea, cricket. Tried some Beethoven sonatas, and I like the idea of Beethoven sonatas and cricket being kind of juxtaposed with one another. So clearly cricket was kind of an ongoing part of their everyday life. And in some sense, I suppose, this shouldn't really be too surprising. I mean, we've reviewed a few things on the podcast that talk about cricket during that era. We've talked about J.M. Barrie's cricket team, the Al-Hakka Barrys, they were called, weren't they, I think?
Yes, yeah.
Which Arthur Conan Doyle was a member of. But, you know, I suppose the thing that seems surprising is that we think of cricket very much as the sort of last bastion of manhood and, I suppose, by extension, of misogyny. And so it seems odd that someone like Virginia Woolf should be getting so involved in it.
I think what's lovely as well is it kind of reminds you of the importance of, garden cricket almost, doesn't it? You know, we always found out, you know, as a podcast, we're always talking about cricket as a professional game. But for so many people who encounter the game, that's what cricket is. It's a couple of stumps in the garden, played with your sister, played with your friends. And I think what I don't know, you know, I wouldn't presume to know enough about Virginia Woolf to make any sort of big assessments, but this is a woman who, you know, struggled with mental health problems throughout her life, through growing up. And, you know, it's quite interesting that she still found sport as an outlet, that it was still something there for her.
Well, what's interesting, when you talk about that kind of garden cricket, the fact about this photo is actually, this photo is very unique, not only in being a photo of Virginia Woolf playing cricket, but also in being a photo of sort of amateur back garden crickets of that era at all, because photography was very rare actually then. The daguerreotype, and if anyone doesn't know what a daguerreotype is, I recommend looking it up, because I can't explain it off the top of my head, but anyway, it's an early form of photography. But anyway, that had only been around for about 40 years. Photography itself was very new indeed. It was very expensive, and actually there was no reason for anyone to be taking pictures in their back garden of people playing cricket. You know, it was an everyday pastime, and it was very expensive to do. So actually, this is quite a, you know, this could have been happening all over the place. The fact is that this is one of the only pieces of evidence that we actually have about this. But what I think is also quite, on a sort of more slightly more philosophical level, what I think is quite interesting about this picture is that actually what it says, if anything, is that the way that the Woolf sisters saw cricket was completely divorced from sort of the cultural context of cricket at the time, that for them it wasn't a case of their sort of taking part in this big, you know, misogynistic professional men dominated game. For them, you know, it was just a part, exactly as we've seen, of their childhood and of their, you know, of their playing around, and something to be sandwiched in between, you know, whatever it was, knitting and playing Beethoven sonatas or something like that. And I think there's something beautiful about that simplicity of the approach to the game for someone who would become so overtly politicized later in their life.
And I guess the decision to take a photo of it suggests that it was something they saw as an important representation of their childhood. You know, if the fact that you, it was so hard to take a photo, it was so hard to record, the fact that you would choose to take a photo of the sisters playing cricket, they obviously thought, you know, this is it, this is an important part of what us being children is.
To the review, and for this episode, we have been reading Angus Bell's Batting on the Bosphorus, a Skoda-powered cricket tour through Eastern Europe. Now, Angus Bell proclaims himself to be, quote, a whiskey-swilling Scotsman who spends his life pursuing misfortune for the sake of a good story. As far as we know, this is his one and only book, and it began in Canada with him talking to a psychic who told him that it was to be his fortune to be guided by a dead great-uncle on a journey that would end in some kind of publication. Did his great uncle have a good case in sending him off on this particular voyage?
He did and he didn't. I found the sort of travelling japes part of this, the kind of, ooh, I met a funny guy in a bar and we were both drunk and things happened, just a little bit wearing. And I'm not sure whether I'm just sort of tiring of this genre a bit, because this is a cricket genre, the kind of, you know, funny cricket travel book. But I also think it maybe does say something about the quality of writing, because this was no Penguin Stopped Play, that excellent Harry Thompson book where, you know, you really got immersed in all these adventures. I found a few of them a little bit wearing. But what it is does brilliantly, this book, is introduce you to an astonishing world of cricket that you never knew about, and some that are making it happen.
I don't think I'd ever in my entire life thought about cricket in Eastern Europe. We've thought about cricket in a lot of places on this podcast, and I don't think it's ever been in Eastern Europe. And what I thought was really interesting about this is that there is this whole world of cricket that exists, and it is completely divorced from what we think of as the sort of epicenters of cricket. You know, we talk a lot about having the top tier of cricket and then the minnows. This isn't just sort of the minnows. This is something, again, that's completely divorced. There's a wonderful moment where he discovers that there's a Bulgarian cricket degree, where you can do a degree that is entirely based on cricket in Bulgaria. And this is a country where no one, as he points out, has ever heard of Freddie Flintoff, and where people actively laugh at you if you suggest to them that Australia plays cricket. And so for that, it was quite an eye-opening read, I thought.
Well, it was an interesting approach to sport, isn't it? If you're going to do sport, you need to do a degree in it. That seems to be the Bulgarian response. But, I mean, it's interesting how, in these countries, you're quite right, they are doing it in their own way. I mean, there's a wonderful story from Slovenia where there's this guy called Boric who has gone to England, found out about the game, and he comes back and he insists that they play cricket properly. They're not going to play, you know, casual cricket. They're going to follow every MCC law. They'll mark the crease out as it in the law book. They'll have no balls, no cricket. And I found there was something kind of heroic about this.
You know, and also the way they keep their scorebooks as well.
And there are statistics being kept professionally. And there was something heroic in this willingness to sort of do things properly.
And similarly, I mean, that way that local communities were sort of taking hold of the game, there's this wonderful story about he goes to this island off Croatia where cricket has been taken. I think it's in the, if I remember correctly, cricket was taken there in the 19th century. And it's this tiny little island where all they seem to do is make wine and play cricket. And, you know, there are these sort of wonderful memories of these people playing cricket and sort of hitting the ball off into the Adriatic. And one of them turns around and says, yeah, I bet you never realised that cricket balls float. And I thought to myself, well, actually, no, I had never realised that cricket balls float. But this was kind of parcel of their game.
And I think it's, I mean, it's an incredible, it really teaches you about the cricket's ability to appeal to so many different people in so many different circumstances. But in all of these cases, it does need these sort of special people to keep it going. I mean, mean, there's this guy in Slovakia, this Vladimir in Slovakia, knocks on the door of around 1,300 villagers to all recruit them to join the team. And I thought, this is mad, but it's brilliant. You know, he loves the game and he feels he has to be evangelical about it. He has to go and get, you know, everyone in the village to find out about it. And it did make me think of, you know, there's the odd club I've come across in England where they moan, oh, you know, the kids aren't into it like they were. They don't teach it at school. It's like, well, you know, get off your backsides and sell it to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's one thing that, Angus Bell, if you are out there listening, that I would be quite interested to know, is that during the book, he comes across two academic papers. Now, one of them charts the impact of cricket as compared to baseball on emerging economies, and this paper concludes that cricket basically makes economies crash, whereas baseball makes economies fly. And the other one is a paper that hypothesizes that Trotsky was in fact a baseball star, and that when he was exiled from Russia by Stalin, he went over to America, became on the back of having played a similar game in Russia, he went over to Ukraine, he went over to America and became a star in the baseball league. It turns out, of course, that both of these papers are spoofs. And I just wonder whether this is a kind of metaphor for the book as a whole, whether these, you know, Bell stumbling across these papers in the first place, stumbling across these spoof papers is in itself a spoof, whether in a sense there are some bits of the book that are a spoof, because some of the book, I think, is quite unbelievable, really, in some of the stories that come across.
Well, he does have an amazing knack of stumbling into things, but I think that often is that maybe is the skill of a good author, of he puts himself in enough positions, he's brave enough in a lot of cases to put himself in enough positions. I mean, he does seem to, there are a couple of moments where you feel you're dealing with a man who's at the end of his tether, you know, he really does seem quite broken by, I think it's in Belarus, where he finally just gets to, he gets treated so appallingly by the border staff, and he just thinks, God, you've got to let me out. I think the final cricketing pioneer of this book, who I would quickly like to pay tribute to, is this wonderful chap called Tamaray in the Ukraine, who runs this Ukrainian cricket tournament and sort of swaggers in to this store manager's home and just demands $10,000 in sponsorship. And I thought, you know, there is just something wonderful about this bravado. And it also reminded me that, you know, cricket's always been about the swindlers and the businessmen. It's always needed those guys often to get the sport going. He described it as a huge error in judgment. After being dismissed first ball in the third T20 between England and West Indies, Ben Stokes took it upon himself to punch a locker, break his wrist, and put himself out of the World T20s. We ask in the debate this episode, do England need more of Stokes' locker-punching spirit?
Well, the kind of off-field antics of cricketers have been something in the news of late. A certain Daniel Worrell of South Australia was, I don't know whether he was fined or suspended, but severely ticked off for graffitiing some genitalia in the pitch before the game. And actually, I think the comparison between the two actions is quite telling, because whereas what Worrell was doing was quite premeditated and frankly utterly stupid, what Ben Stokes did, I actually quite admire and I quite like. I think it's a kind of genuine knee-jerk reaction to a dismissal. As long as he's doing that kind of thing in the locker room rather than out in the middle, then I don't really see that there can be much harm in it.
I actually was thinking a lot about the club I play at, and there is a huge difference in the way people respond to being dismissed. There are the quite fatalistic players, especially some of the, you know, particularly useless ones, who will stroll back very nonchalantly for their, you know, eighth consecutive duck, and it, you know, none of it's really that surprising to them. But you do have some fantastic tantrums. You know, you've seen bats hurled around. And I just, it seems to just be a very individual thing. I don't think it's necessarily a reflection on sort of good or bad players, but actually being out is something that people do process in very different ways.
Well, it's interesting. Earlier in the podcast, you were talking about the fact that England have become very bad at taking on criticism. And that England seem, you know, there's this sort of thing in the 21st century with all the sort of press teams that you have, whenever anyone talks, you know, whenever any player talks to a journalist and everything, everyone gives the same monochrome answers to absolutely everything. And it's quite nice sometimes to see a cricketer saying and showing in a very visual way that they realise that they haven't, you know, they haven't been good enough at what they're supposed to do, and that they're actually pretty pissed off about the fact. I mean, obviously, all of this is, it goes without saying, it's a little bit stupid that he's managed to rule himself out of the World 2020s by breaking his wrist. So maybe you don't need to go that far. But having that kind of visceral reaction, I would say, is quite important.
Well, I suppose one of the things that made the recent Ashes so depressing was this sense of surrender. It was a sense, and it's actually been well expressed by Ashley Giles since, I think, that there was a sense that I think the England players had lost what they were playing for. They'd lost an understanding of what they were playing for. And it does at least sort of show passion and emotion. I guess with all these things, though, there's that ability to kind of keep these things under control as well, to kind of harness that as well. I mean, I sometimes think of someone like Chris Gayle batting. I mean, Chris Gayle's batting is an act of utter aggression and sort of sheer savagery. But when he's at his best, it's so controlled as well. Yeah. You know, there's that focus, there's that intensity, but it's so controlled. And maybe for a young cricketer like Stokes, that's the real challenge.
Now, just one final thought, which is actually, I don't think that this is the fault of Ben Stokes. I think this is the fault of the England management. Because surely a management that can come up with a manual that's, you know, 250 pages long or whatever it was during the Ashes, telling the players what to eat, should at least have the foresight of adding some padding to the lockers and to the wall of the changing room.
They should have a procedure, surely. You know, when you get out, there's a clear procedure, punch here. Or punch someone.
Yeah, exactly. Or they take you into a padded room, leave you there for 10 minutes, you get it all out of your system, and then on from there.
That's our suggestion to the New England coach.
So that, ladies and gentlemen, is the 56th episode of Reverse Web Radio. Since we recorded the last episode, we've been very touched by the number of tweets and emails that we've had welcoming us back onto the airwaves. The last episode was a bit of a pilot issue to see whether our interhemispherical incarnation, as I think we christened it, was going to work. We think it is going to work, and so we're pleased to say that we're here to stay, and we're glad to have you with us too.